One quick message before I start the show. You can find all the links and resources for this episode by visiting the show notes on rickyrichards.com. If you enjoy this episode, do consider subscribing on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you're feeling particularly generous, you can help me to grow the show by leaving a review on iTunes. For anyone who does subscribe, review or share, thank you. I appreciate it. Now let's get into the show. Welcome to Ricky Richards Represents, the show where I talk tips for success with leading figures of creativity and innovation. Hello everyone and welcome to the show. Thank you for tuning in again. My guest today is Andrew Diprose. Andrew is the creative director of Wired Magazine, a globally distributed magazine that has a distribution of roughly 50,000 issues and a readership of over 250,000 people worldwide. Andrew has just won the Designer of the Year award at the Professional Publishers Association, or PPA for short. But I wanted to talk to Andrew about his journey into the industry, as well as his instrumental role in the shaping of Wired. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the podcast. I should start by saying welcome to my guest today, Andrew. Hello, thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me here.
The first thing I should probably point out is you've just won an award, so congratulations. Could you explain what that was?
Yeah, I am PPA Designer of the Year for 2017, which I'm super pleased about, you know, Press and Publishing Association, and it's a proper accolade, and there was a really good, you know, good field, good entries this year, good competition, and, you know, I made up, you know, I won the award, I don't know, about 6 years ago, and to, you know, to come back and win again, I'm delighted.
And so what did you do to celebrate?
Weirdly enough, I was ill, and so, you know, I phoned up my wife afterwards, and I was like, yeah, and she's like, oh, you're going to get a Negroni in, and, you know, and I was like, honestly, I feel terrible, I'm just hanging on through the night.
Cowpole.
Yeah, exactly, it was like that, a bit of cowpole, a bit of night nurse, and, yeah, early to bed.
So you've worked for like a number of brands, ID Magazine, or I say brands for magazines, ID Magazine, GQ, Esquire, and now Wired. That's quite a heavy editorial mix. And I just thought, could you maybe explain what attracted you to the industry and your journey to Wired, I guess?
Yeah, it's been a long and slightly meandering journey. I studied graphic design in Southampton. I did a degree in graphic design. And the last year of the course, everything I made had a magazine format, a book format, a published format. You know, I was doing screen printing and photography, and everything I did was putting together these little stories and these collections of graphic design and illustration or graphic design and photography. And towards the end of the course, this art director called Scott King from ID Magazine came in. And Scott is now a bona fide artist, but at that time he—I know it's funny for me to say that—but at that time he was art director of ID Magazine, and it was, you know, ID was really in its heyday. ID's fantastic now, but it really still had the end of that, almost that kind of cut and paste. It was, you know, they had while I was in there interning, they had one Apple Mac. You know, it was cut and paste, enlarging on a PMT machine, type was properly set, you know, real old school cut and paste stuff now. And he came in to talk at my college, and he was just fantastic. He's got a fantastic sense of humour, really irreverent. Everything he does is like a mix of kind of graphic design and art. You know, he'd done this peculiar kind of situationist sort of work when he was at college. And I thought, this guy's fantastic, and he does magazines, and I love magazines, and I love ID Magazine. Can I come and do some work up in London? And I saw him, you know, a good few years later, and I was like, I've got you to thank, stroke blame, for all of my time, my entire career in the magazine industry. But I went from, you know, spending some time at ID Magazine, and then my first job was at Smash Hits Magazine, doing pop music. And then I went on to Sky Magazine then, which was super fun and getting a little bit more fashion-y. And from there, I spent my time all over the place, like you say, like, you know, some time at Esquire, Arena Magazine. I did FHM Collections, the fashion spin-off, for a few years. I freelanced for a long time, Elle Magazine. I ended up at Tatler Magazine. And then from Tatler, I went to GQ, GQ to the launch of Wired.
So why all the jumping about, I guess?
This was over a good amount of time.
Right.
You know, this year, I haven't thought on this hard, but it's probably, you know, I've probably been a magazine designer for 22 years. So, you know, for some time I'd gone full time, and some time I'd gone like freelance, and I'd work on special projects like the FHM collections thing. And I was also sort of hungry for change. You know, I moved up through the ranks pretty young. I was art director at Sky Magazine when I was 27, I think, maybe 28. And that's super young, you know. Looking back now, I don't know whether I really knew what I was doing. But it was a lot of fun at the time. And I guess, you know, I started wanting to learn and work with good people and with good brands. You know, I loved Arena magazine as a reader. I loved Esquire magazine as a reader. And to go in, be a magazine lover, and to go into these places and work is, you know, it's a joy.
So talking about the things you've learned along the way and everything, I know that you, or I believe I know that you were there for the manifestation of Wired UK.
Yeah. I was a really big fan of Wired in the US, especially the art team there. It was just fantastic. Scott Dadich, who's went on to be editor-in-chief and has recently left. He was art director at the time there. People like Carl de Torres, brilliant designers there, brilliant editorial designers, and the team was just like, it was like, I don't know, I don't really follow football, but I'm just thinking of, like, you know, the example of like just a world class team. Everything that they were doing, you know, the magazine was landing on my desk at GQ, and I was dying inside every month seeing what they were doing. It was amazing, the production values, you know, the resources they had. So I was already a fan of Wired, and when the general manager said that they were going to launch one in the UK, I leapt at the chance. You know, I straight away sent an email going, you know, this is my job, and luckily it was.
So what was the idea in the early days, and how, I guess, has that morphed over time?
Well, the early days was that we would, you know, bear in mind that this was, you know, the launch was in 2008. And, you know, the recession was already kicking in. It was a bold move. You know, magazines were just, you know, falling. But the idea was that, you know, there were fantastic stories, you know, ideas and technology stories that were happening in Europe and the rest of the world that maybe weren't covered or weren't covered in as much depth by the US edition, and that, you know, the UK and Europe could really have a voice and sustain Wired magazine, you know, on its own. And we were there to tell those stories.
So were you like influential in basically asking them to launch a UK edition, and why was your name put forward?
The decision had already been made before I got there. I heard that there was rumour, though, thinking about it. But, you know, at that time, probably a lot more than there is now, there was a hunger still for launching magazines and for special projects. And I'd spent quite a lot of time at Condé Nast working on special projects behind the scenes while I was at GQ, you know, magazines launched that didn't happen or turned into other magazines. And I really enjoyed doing that, you know, working on special projects. And so my name, I think, was already passed around as somebody who could, you know, who could do that, turn their hand to that sort of thing.
I'm curious to know, for people that aren't so familiar with the magazine process, myself included in that, how you actually go about sourcing stories, and is it something where you work multiple copies in advance, or?
Yeah, we're probably working with six or seven issues, you know, on the go. You know, there may be, you know, a feature story idea that's, you know, will be pegged now for a March edition or a February edition. And then obviously, as you're getting closer and closer to date, things are a little bit more time sensitive. You know, start filling up the gaps, you know, the front sections, you know, the regulars. But the big in-depth stories where there's a lot of investigative time and photo shoots, you know, around the world have got to be hooked up. Obviously, they need to be done in months in advance.
So for someone, you just said, mentioned about having the hunger to start magazines. Say there's people out there now who really want to create one. And if you had to condense, say, three things, and if that's all you were able to tell them, to give them some advice for launching their own, what would those three things be?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that question, because I did, you know, the Ride Journal as well as I do Wired magazine. The Ride Journal's on hold at issue 10 now, but that was a magazine that I did with my brother, a proper independent magazine. So I've got, you know, I come from a real full newsstand, big publisher angle, and an independent magazine angle. Probably for the if it's an individual thinking that themselves, I would say with the benefit of my Rye Journal hat on, I would say, don't think how long it's going to take you to do it, because it's going to take five times as long. And if you're already counting how long a magazine might take, you know, or I can give it a couple of, you know, hours tonight, or I might give it a Saturday every couple of things. It's not. It's if you're going to do a good job of it, it's going to be every day you're going to be emailing, every day you're going to be thinking about it. At the weekends, it's going to eat your weekends. You know, it's going to be, you know, eat your weekdays. You know, you're going to come home, turn your computer back on after doing what you've been doing in the day, and then you're going to be back into this thing. But if you love it, you love it, so you don't mind doing it. So don't count the time. Find somebody who is equally as invested in it as you are. So, you know, I think if you are an art director, find a brilliant editor or a brilliant writer. If you're a brilliant writer, find somebody who's an amazing designer who's committed to it. Because, you know, if you're working with three or four different people, five people, two or three of them will fall by the wayside. All the sane ones will want to leave. And then, so that's two. What's the last one? I think put your heart into it. You know, it sounds, if you're going to go out of your way to put all this time into it and your energy, this is your mouthpiece. You know, you may not love what you do 9 to 5 or 9 to 6 or 8 to 6. You know, you might not love that, but if you're using this as an opportunity to get your work out there, to show people what you can do, and as a place for creative expression, oh my goodness, go for it, or don't bother doing it.
I think that's amazing advice, and I can see how passionate you are even to this day about what you do. So is this something that in your afternoons you still go home and produce your indie mag?
Yeah, I'm working on various things, and I'm working on a book project with Thames and Hudson at the moment. And you know, I enjoy doing some books. You know, up until recently, I was doing the Rye Journal, so I always had that in the back of the mind. I kind of want to do things about. I want to do some early '90s rave kind of fanzine at the moment. I've been thinking a bit about. I have these things turning over in my mind, and whenever a project finishes, you know, I know this book project is going to come to a finish soon. And when that finishes, I'm already just starting to itch around, thinking, should I just play with something? Maybe I could do something with newspaper. I have these things in the back of my mind that you know, they're kind of an itch to scratch when I'm not doing Wired magazine. I have these other little graphic styles or these ideas that I like to try out.
Talking about ideas, I believe I read in one of your interviews that one of the things that really you find appealing about the editorial industry is the fact that it's on a quick turnaround basis, and so you have the license to come up with ideas. What are some of the more prominent ideas that you feel you've had over the years?
Oh goodness. Well, you're completely right. You know, that is a fantastic thing about magazines. You know, you get to succeed and fail every issue, you know, and so, you know, I get an issue come out and I'm like, that was an utter disaster. But do you know what? Next month, I'm going to smash it. You know, and some months I have some, you know, something that goes particularly well and I'd like to revisit it, but then it's gone and I've got another tough story to, you know, to contend with. It's a fascinating place, and the turnaround is exhilarating. I did a fun thing recently. We did a really big package that was about Russian hacking and Putin, and, you know, elections being influenced by state-controlled hackers. And I wanted to put together these essays in a way that was a bit special. There's a lot of words. It was pretty heavy going. And, you know, part of my remit is to make this, you know, this stuff that's hard to visualise and this dense information palatable for people. So I started researching this kind of post-constructivist magazine called USSR and Construction. It was amazing. They had brilliant photographers and graphic designers at the time working for it. It was 30s Russia. So I went and researched all of these collage illustrations and the way they did photo collages with these very flat colours. You know, they were obviously, they couldn't do four colour printing at the time, so you'd have one or two colours. So I really got into the idea of doing something like that and reproduced it with our four colour presses by clearing out the units, all of the ink units. So there was no CMYK in there, which nobody does. maybe because it's quite expensive, but nobody does it anyway. We cleared the CMYK out and we filled it with four different Pantone inks. You know, we had a fluoro, we had a metallic, we had two peculiar Pantone colours, stuff that we could never do with CMYK. And so, you know, the richness of the printing and this, you know, this hark back to this old magazine style, that was super fun. And that was only a couple of months ago.
So plenty of them over the years.
Yeah. Good stuff.
There was one cover which I saw you talk about in the past, which was a failure edition with, who was on the cover of that? It was
Alan Sugar.
Alan Sugar, there you go. And there was one thing that caught my eye, and it was that obviously on a traditional magazine, you typically have the title at the top of the magazine so that it appears when it's in newsstands. And the idea was obviously that you'd offset the print and made it look like it was a failed run. But then you kind of had to put Wired at the top of the magazine again. And so I wondered if at the time when you were coming up with that idea, did it feel like you'd had to give up on a bit of the idea because you still had to put the Wired at the top?
Well, that's a very astute observation, actually. Yeah, that cover, I ran two logos, which obviously pleads to management because, you know, we have to bear that kind of thing in mind. And it's a perfect illustration of how magazines work. You know, we can tell these fun stories, we can be creative, we can energise the reader, we can, you know, confront the reader with, you know, something sort of shocking or alarming, but within the constraints of selling the magazine and telling the story, you know, and part of what I do is pulling back these ideas so that they are not disrespectful to the people we're working with. They sell the magazine and they tell the story. So with that one, of course, yeah, I dropped the logo down and I had fake, you know, colour bars and registration marks. But we had like a ghosted white logo up there too. Yeah, that would have been a disaster, yeah, if that hadn't sold.
That's funny. You recently went through a big redesign, and I know you work with collaborators, people like Sawdust, and I'm sure there's others. I just wondered if, firstly, you could talk about why it's essential to redesign the magazine, and also maybe talk about a few of the people that you work with on a consistent basis.
Call it a redesign or a refresh. We probably did that for a couple of reasons. One, that the content of the magazine had changed. We had a new editor on board and he wanted to shift around the sections. He wanted to shift around how long the sections were. So the actual, you know, the actual geography of the magazine changed. And the way it was designed beforehand, yeah, we could have kind of stretched it around and made it work, but we had new sections. So we thought, you know, there's only so far we can push it where it's a little bit of a compromise. Also, you know, the way that we think about designing the magazine or how we keep the reader engaged, that changes over time as well. You know, how many words we're running in a story. You know, we there are things under the hood that we want to fix as well. You know, peculiar paragraph settings where you have, you know, where you might have a narrow column where words are breaking too easily. You know, body copy that's a little bit harder to read than it should be. Things to do with, oh my goodness, this is magazine geekery, but you know, the positions of you know, folios, the page numbers and the slugs, what we do with that, how people navigate through the magazine. There are a million different tiny little touches, and we thought it was a good opportunity to do all of those in one go with a new editor. And it also gave us an opportunity to kind of just sort of refresh the aesthetic, you know, which is great for the designers as well as for the readers, you know.
Of course. In the second segment of the interview, I wanted to ask Andrew about the business of content and editorial. In recent years, a number of publications have reduced their circulation due to an increase in pressure from online media. Wired is one of the few magazines that has diversified and built a strong digital offering. I wanted to find out about the business side and what he's seen change during the rise of the internet and digital media. As someone who's been in editorial for quite a while, I'm sure you will have seen the transition through the rise of the internet and how that's kind of changed the landscape. I know magazines have struggled somewhat at times, but through that, Wired has managed to remain fairly prevalent. Do you have any observations of what's occurred over those years?
Yes, it's been a massive massive shift. You know, it's been fun time, but it doesn't stay still for 3 months. You know, something changes when we set up Wired. You know, there was going to be, you know, the website, but it wasn't really a priority. There was no digital magazines. There's no, you know, people weren't really reading content on it. Yeah, okay, you know, the iPhone was out. What are we looking at? It's 10-year anniversary, so it'd been out for a couple of years. But people really weren't, you know, engaging with content on it in that way. Nobody was thinking about, you know, an iPad magazine. Nobody was really thinking about commissioning video for websites, which is a really big thing for us now. Things have changed radically. You know, the Wired's business now, a lot of our business is in events and consulting. So, you know, we think of Wired as a brand. And, you know, I'm really, really enthusiastic about print, but I'm enthusiastic about how we tell stories, you know, on the web. I'm enthusiastic about how we look with our events. You know, we are telling our stories. So you may pick up our story, you know, in a print magazine or online, but you may come and see it face to face with that person, you know, the subject of the story live, you know, at one of our events, you know, Wired Health or our main event, Wired Security. Or, you know, we can share our knowledge and our contacts. You know, we can share those stories with companies, you know, one-on-one and tailor events for them. So it really is, you know, from those early days when I say I was in with, you know, ID magazine, you know, cutting and pasting, it's a seismic shift. But, you know, in the core of all of that is telling stories, photography, illustration, dealing with amazing writers, great subject matter. And that thing is universal. Like, you know, it's kind of, if you're thinking about Wired as a globe, that's like the core of the hot core of the earth.
That's a great metaphor.
Yeah, the kind of weird bubbly scary bit there.
Yeah, so do you think that looking at Wired as a brand, is the magazine still the prevalent, like you say, is that still the core, and is it still the core of their revenue model as well?
That's a great question. No, we won't be getting rich on the print magazine. Everybody knows that now. But the print magazine is very important for us because it is the way that a lot of our audience, you know, encounters the brand first off. You know, that they are subscribers or they buy it on the newsstand. They're familiar with it. They're familiar with our design values on our and you know, all of the quality sort of, you know, kind of emanates from that sort of bubble. But they'll get that online too. You know, we're in an age where we're thinking, what is print doing for us? You know, it is a time when we are celebrating it for being like a luxury item now. You know, when somebody can flick up, you know, and read brilliant Wired stories on their phone, you know, hanging on a rail in the underground or on the train or whatever on their way in, we're hopefully making print a place, like a destination for seeing amazing photography with great production values, long reads in a comfortable, easy to read environment where you can settle in, and something that's tactile. You know, you're going to want to feel it. You're going to want to feel the grit cover in your hands and the weight of the paper. Things that we've, you know, we are really passionate about maintaining the quality of this product, and you're going to have it on your side at home. And over time, I think the magazines that are probably going to be most successful on the newsstand are the ones that people are going to want to hold in their hands, and they're going to want to value as an object, because that's what it is at the end of the day.
So just to be completely transparent, if you don't mind, with regards to the magazine, so that'll be a touch point for people. They'll feel the quality, they'll experience the brand, they'll experience the stories, they may go online. And then does Wired have like an online subscription model as well? And is it the events that come off the back of it where there's and consultancy and all that kind of thing?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we you know, I'm a bit of a hippie about all of this thing, and I think this is a brilliant thing about magazines in an age where people are talking about content this and content that, and we're filling up pages with content, and, you know, oh yeah, we're mentioning this brand, but, you know, it's not really like that because we're giving people added value. Like, magazines, when they're at their best, are absolutely, it's entertainment and information, proper credible research, great writing. You know, I'm really passionate about
it.
You know, it's like it's you know, yes, I'm a real big magazine fan, but I really hope that people are, you know, value when you get a great magazine. Sure, there are a ton of magazines where it falls down, where they're not credible, where you know. But I hope that the core of brilliant magazines is, you know, is appreciated by people. Now, print magazine advertising is on the decline. People want to spend the money online, but we're there, you know, to take that money when it's online. And you know, the conference, you know, having conferences are really important to us. And as a business model, it's really important for the survival of Wired, things like that. Not everybody's doing it, but it works really well for our audience. I hope that, you know, a great magazine is valued for and over time, I hope that, you know, as you know, more and more stuff is thrown up online, that great journalism, wherever it is you know, is valued.
Out of interest, with regards to the journalism and the stories, how much of it is kind of within your remit? Are you able to shape what goes into the magazine, or does it fall
on the editor? Is this between us, or is between this and me and the editors?
Yeah, that's it. I wonder.
I hope that, you know, decent art directors do a lot more than put down type on page or commission a great photography, that I hope that I can be a sounding board to my editor for what is, you know, what is commercial, what is good storytelling, what's exciting, what's important, what part of the story needs pulling out, the shape and tone of the magazine over time. You know, I'm, you know, just as passionate about that kind of thing, steering a brand. I'm not, you know, I can turn my hand to writing a few words here and there, but I'm not, you know, like I said earlier, the brilliant thing about great magazines is that I'm sitting there with experts. You have so many different people in one place, which I think is quite unique. Sure, you know, you could be working in an agency and have writers and designers together and stuff, but you have, you know, I could sit with a science editor who has an entirely different brain than I do, you know, and I'm bringing my visual eye to something, and I'm working with people who are amazing at production, people who are great writers, you know. It's just a great melting pot of people, you know. But, yeah, this is probably a rambling answer to your question, but I think I have quite a good run, and I hope I add value.
I'm sure you do. I mean, I enjoy the mag. Talking about a melting pot, Condé Nast is obviously a massive umbrella for what is a bunch of different publications. Is that something that... is there ever any cross-pollination between the companies, and is there a competitive nature in the Condé Nast ecosystem, or, you know, are people trying to see who sells the most magazines that month? Is it, or are you very siloed?
I think we're all together, and I'm really proud. I go to talk to, you know, our production department. It's in Vogue House, which is across the Hanover Square from our building, and I'm really proud to walk in there and see all the magazines, GQ and Vogue, and you know, it's a great company where, you know, I think quality is valued, and that brings people together. The magazines are very, very different. You know, Vogue, think about Vogue, think about Wired, think about GQ, World of Interiors, House and Garden. They're such different beasts that I don't think that you can compare like for like on a lot of them. You know, it's, I feel like Wired is the run to the litter when I walk in there, but in a very good way. You know, we feel like the ungainly child, you know, but that's kind of cool too. And, you know, when I walk in there and see all the covers together, you know, it's very different what we do, but I think everybody, you know, attacks what they do with passion and, you know, quality, and that probably brings us together. But I don't think Jamie on Vogue or Paul on GQ or whatever, I don't think, you know, I'm sure, I hope they, you know, think that, yeah, that ended up being a good Wired cover, or, you know, Wired looks tight inside or whatever, but it's very different at the end of the day what we're doing, you know, what they're doing and what we're doing. I don't know, I say very different. You know, a good magazine hopefully will be engaging and be easy to navigate and have great photography in it and stuff. But I think, you know, if you talk about kind of stylistics or whatever, I think I don't think I can be competing with Vogue.
You briefly touched on there on covers, and I think it would be a shame of me not to talk about covers and their importance. One of my heroes growing up was George Lois, and his conceptual mind was obviously hugely influential for Esquire, which ended up in the Museum of Modern Art, I think, in New York. typically Wired, I mean, they have graphical covers with typography, they have object-based, they also use portraiture. Is there something that works particularly well, and what kind of trends within covers have resulted in big good sales for the magazine?
Covers is like a joy in a minefield. Like you say, like a wide cover could have a picture of a person on there, or be purely graphic or an object. And we have worked, I've spoken on this before actually, but we have worked ourselves into a lather with expensive shoots, shooting people, retouching conceptual ideas, crazy stuff, to have an okay sale, and then to have the next month put down a very simple word on a fluoro background that everybody engages with, and boo, there's a massive sale like there, you know. And we've surprised, you know, we've had some covers, like we did a cover on Raspberry Pi, you know, the miniature UK miniature computer, and it was a picture of a Raspberry Pi shot very nicely by Wilson Hennessy, looked great. I fiddled around, I was playing around with having a fantastic typographer did a headline for me, and then I ditched it because I thought I could make something more easily readable at the last minute. And I just thought, right, let's just make this commercial. It was bright red, which does really well for us on newsstand. Massive sales. It was a miniature computer. No eye contact, you know, no prop of being a famous person or a model. You know, they weren't attractive. They weren't any particular colour. It was a weird computer, but it sold really well because everybody... It had a lot of fans, you know, people love Raspberry Pi. It was a great UK success story, and it had a great cover line. And I think, you know, there's so many factors for covers, you know, the cover line, the colour, the time of year, whether people are travelling, whether people, you know, whether there's snow on the ground. There are so many factors. Every month is a surprise.
Wow. So do you take into consideration those factors every month, or...?
Occasionally, we try to keep, you know, we have in the editor's office, we have the last, you know, few years up on the wall. And we look through, you know, to see stars of photography that have been popular, ways of writing cover lines that have been popular, colours, the variety of colours. You know, obviously, I don't want every issue to come out looking the same with the same sort of, you know, treatment. I think as a reader, you know, you need that variety. But there are a ton of factors, and I've got a ton of factors. You know, I also have in my mind, you know, what's Wired style? You know, what are Wired US doing at the moment? What, you know, Wired Italy doing at the moment? Where are we in the Wired brand? What's our, you know, what is, you know, particular to us? You know, what is going to pass with the management when I go for a, you know, a cover meeting at the end of the month? What are people buying? What do our readers expect? What do the readers want? And what do they expect? And, you know, all of these things I have a million different heads on when I'm working on a cover. Hopefully I get it right sometimes.
In the final question segment of the interview, I wanted to ask Andrew about how his life at the helm of a globally recognised brand affects him day to day. I wanted to know how much input he has in choosing the content of the magazine and what experiences he's had as a result. When people want to approach the magazine in order to maybe get featured, typically it's known as a press release or a press story. Posing a hypothetical, imagine that you're somebody that wants to get their work into Wired or to maybe not Wired, any magazine. What are some of the tips for people that, you know, aren't well connected and would like to get their story out there, but want to do it in the appropriate manner? How should magazines be approached?
Are you talking for like photography and illustration or a story idea?
Let's use me for an example. Yeah. So I'm a struggling podcaster who's trying to find any opportunity to reach an audience.
Yeah.
Someone like Wired or any magazine would be amazing, obviously, because if it aligned with my listenership. I have zero idea how I would go about approaching any publication, and I'm sure lots of listeners are in the same position.
Yeah.
So curious to know how it goes about.
It is tough, you know. I would think, you know, that I would look and see the person who's most relevant on the masthead to you. You know, if you're pitching a science story, if you can find a science editor, if you're somebody who's a front section editor or a web editor, if that's the kind of person you're after, an art director or a senior designer or a designer, maybe that, you know, if you move slightly further down the masthead, you might have more luck, you know, chance and reply. But I think if you're if your email is short and succinct and you've got something that's interesting and something of value and you can attach work in a way that's easy to look through, you know, I get plenty of these every day, and I hope that, you know, whereas I might not reply to everybody, I will have a look at absolutely everything. And if it's something that, you know, people who work on magazines are magpies, you know, they will be looking and they'll be thinking, how can you make me look good? If you can, you're in. You know, I want to find that brilliant illustrator I haven't heard of. I want to find that photographer or somebody who's doing some animation. I'll need those people. I want to hear about them, but only if they're good.
That's fascinating. So it comes through an email rather than there's no... like a press release isn't a formatted thing.
No, I think if people feel like it's formatted, they're not going to think it's personal, and they're going to think you're sending it to 100 people. You might be sending it to 100 people, but if somebody feels like you've bashed out a thing and something's been pre-written and it's just going to roll through, they're going to think, ah, they sent it to 100 different people. Maybe they aren't quite so passionate about Wired, or they don't know me, or they, you know, they might be using a kind of a scattergun effect, and that's not so appealing.
I'm talking about appeal. I imagine that one of the appealing things of Wired is that you get to meet, you know, fairly influential people occasionally. And I wondered if you could maybe share a few people that you've met and who was particularly interesting.
Yeah, some lovely people I've worked with, brilliant illustrators and photographers. We were shooting with Platon the other day. Like, you know, he's amazing. Like, when you're working with people who... you know, you look at their work and you're in awe of it, you know, people like that. You know, the brilliant thing about being an art director is somebody's asking me about it at the weekend, and they were just saying they didn't really understand. They were kind of like, so you don't draw any of the pictures, and you don't take any of the photographs, and yet you're, you know, kind of in control of the visuals for this magazine. And you know, kind of like took me back a tiny amount. And I was thinking, I sort of said, that's the brilliant thing about it. I can work with the best photographer who's 100 times better than I am, who, you know, can interpret my idea in an idea, and or take their idea and tell a story with it. Or I can work with the best photographer in the world, you know, somebody whose style I could never achieve, much as I'm an okay photographer and an okay illustrator, and put these people together. Oh my goodness, the satisfaction when you open a magazine or you scroll down a website and you see these photographs backlit and you're like, damn, look what they've done. You know what I mean? Like, I can't do that, but I brought this together. I connected those people. I connected those stories, or, you know, I made them look good and they made me look good.
Yeah, nice bit of curation and the upside of it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the highlight and the upside of what you do. I'm curious to know what the biggest fuck up is over the years. You know, what's really gone down horribly, or...
I've had some stinkers, like cover meetings where I have, you know, walked in with an idea that I just thought was fantastic, that I've worked hard on. Maybe, you know, we did a cover a couple of years ago where I had a photographer shoot a model, and then I had somebody 3D render a kind of like a transparent body. You know, it was about health devices. It was like a this woman's body, and it was kind of, you could see inside her for this kind of health tracking, and I put together this photograph and this amazing 3D render. Brian Christie Design in the States did this whole thing for me. I put the whole thing together, had a integrated fluoro running through it. I turned up to the CEO's office with the editor, and everybody stood around and just looked at me, and they were like, what's this weird woman that looks like a zombie, like anorexic, like peculiar, frightening, half person, half dead, you know? And I was like, but it's not really like that. It's very clever. And that was a disaster. That whole thing just like shot apart. You know, that was a particularly bad one. But I've had some covers go up there and just, you know, not work or not be received well, not be commercial, and had to pull those back. You know, the way we work in the UK is pretty different than a lot of magazines, especially in the States, where you have such a strong subscription model where, you know, the cover has to work. It's a little bit more commercial, often brighter. You know, the cover lines are a little bit more kind of European. We may have a couple more because we're not relying on subscribers quite so heavily. So, you know, things can get, you know, I still get, I'm coming up for my 100th cover for Wired, and I'm still pretty nervous when I go to the cover meetings.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. obviously, with the content of the magazine, you kind of get a little bit of a glimpse into the future. And I thought it'd be interesting to see what some of the things you're excited about that are emerging.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to be excited about and nervous about. That's the brilliant thing with Wired. You know, I'm quite often, you know, I'm that guy who's, you know, still in the meetings going, no way, that's not happening, come on. You know, obviously, you know, artificial intelligence, you know, connected homes, wearables, all of that that's out there. But we've, you know, we've got some brilliant stories coming up, crime stories where people are using, I don't know whether I should talk about this, actually. Maybe I should hold that down. But, you know, that's one of the things that I'm most enthusiastic about, where you see people apply artificial intelligence, you know, to solving crime. People apply virtual reality to mental health problems. People, you know, Wired is at its best is like a magazine about hybrids, you know, music and artificial intelligence coming together, you know, prosthetics plus theatre. You know, all of these things are hybrids, and that's the thing that I'm excited about. People using, harnessing these new technologies and these new ideas to solve problems and, you know.
Talking about ideas, this is an idea which is not so new now, but I'm sure you're familiar with it. So Mr. Kevin Kelly, who's the, I believe, the founder, or is the American founder?
Yeah, American.
He has a philosophy which is the 1,000 true fans. And I wondered if you agreed with that as a philosophy, and also if you do, if you could maybe talk it up and explain what that is.
I don't know. We often talk about this thing, like how, you know, how engaged your audience is. And if we can, you know, like if we can have that fan base who are out there selling the magazine to other people. You know, my biggest joy is when I bump into people. I had to pick somebody in for a meeting earlier and they were super cool and I was trying to give them a copy of the magazine. And they were like, I'm already a subscriber, I don't need to see it. Like, that's the biggest thing, you know. I want to, you know, great magazines keep their subscribers happy and they keep their subscribers engaged. Yeah, more of that.
More of that. Final question before I get into some quick fires. You're a dad. And you also are, you know, you're heading a company which is, for a lot of people, it's highly respected. And I'm sure there's a lot of work goes into it. And I just wondered if you could maybe talk about, very briefly maybe, about, you know, what's it like to be a dad, going through the process of having a career as well, and also, you know, how you juggle those two things.
Yeah. There's this... other part of my life which is completely different, which is brilliant. You know, like I leave the work I've done on Wired, where I've completely had my head down and I've been absorbed by it, you know, and I'm so fired up by it, and then I come in through the front door and nobody cares, and that's really fun as well. You know, my daughter doesn't say like, oh dad, did, were you killing it with the photography today, I heard you had that big shoot. No, they don't even care. They'll come and like give you a hug and they'll mess around, and my daughter will like play a violin and the other one will just jump on me, or she says she doesn't want a hug, or somebody will spill something on the floor. They don't care, and it's brilliant. And it completely, you know, I ride my bike into work and back every day, and I have this little buffer, you know, however busy I've been and however switched on with work I've been, I can have that buffer where I'm calming down on my way back home. Again, takes me 25 minutes, half an hour, go in, see the kids, and it's a priority for me every day. Like, you know, I want to run the art department. It's really important, you know. Part of what I do is you know, a big part of what I do is attracting brilliant people, brilliant designers to work with me, people on the photo desk, you know, people, you know, doing the digital edition. And I want to retain those people. I don't want those people working all of the hours. I want people to have a healthy work, you know, life balance, be happy. And I want the same for myself. I want to be able to leave the magazine. Those days when I was on Sky magazine and I was starting to design a feature at, you know, midnight, or see proofs at 7 o'clock in the morning, you know, I don't think that's sustainable, especially if you've got a family. So I want to, you know, I'm also conscious, I want to make Wired an environment like a creative environment where that feels like safe, and where people are valued and people have a life outside Wired as well. Like, that's cool.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I wish all people had the same kind of philosophy. A few quick fire questions for you. So I know you're very much into your cycling. You have your own, or Is it still going, your own publication?
Yeah, it's on hold. It depends whether you're talking to me. I'll say yes, it's still going, and my brother, who's the editor. You know, we need to have a break, like doing, you know, obviously doing a independent magazine is like a ton. It's like a time suck.
And what,
like
what's the name of that?
It's called the Ride Journal.
And can people still subscribe?
People can. You can't subscribe to it, but we've still got issue 9 and a few issue 10, but not many that are on the ridejournal.com site. You can buy that with PayPal. But yeah, it's on hold at issue 10 for now.
So I assume that you're fairly clued up about bikes, seems as that's been a fairly heavy topic for you. So if you were going to buy a road bike for less than £1,000, what brand would you buy? What model maybe?
I would either go for something. This is a tough one because I have a few industry pals. Like Genesis make a brilliant bike. Depends what you bike, what want the bike for. So, you know, we can disappear down a wormhole of questions. If you're looking for a like a recap,
gut instincts.
Okay, gut instincts. I might turn up to Condor Cycles. They're good folks, and I'd probably buy it on the, you know, the bike to work scheme. Put a couple of extra quid in myself. Buy something with discs. Buy something, you know, medium lightweight. Buy something steel. Something that's going to last for years. Something comfortable.
Very practical. Other than Wired, what other magazines or podcasts do you subscribe to?
I have a subscription to New York Magazine, Outside Magazine. We have a ton of magazines in the office that come in, you know, regularly. Wired Italia is brilliant. Wired US is brilliant. I'm a real fan of US magazines. I like the format. And like I hinted at earlier, they have, you know, great resources, plentiful staff, and I think, you know, it's often reflected in the, you know, in the quality of the design. Occasionally I listen to a podcast, but it's only really when I'm traveling. Yeah, I did the Serial thing and stuff like that. I like it, yeah. But I don't because my time is purely listening to things is tight. I don't get like a ton of time like that because I'm riding on my bike and I don't condone the whole like headphone riding thing. I think it's too sketchy in London. So yeah, it's mainly magazines at home, but I have a pile I work my way through. Man, I could go on about that. I love Avant magazine. What have I got? I've got the Cos magazine at the moment.
If you had to name one indie mag that people should go out and buy.
Oh goodness. I really like Avant magazine. I'm a little bit worried it's going to shut. You know, Matt Willey is one of the guys, you know, he's genius art director who's at New York Times Magazine. And, yeah, it's real nice.
Please go out and subscribe. don't let it shut. Favourite book or learning resource?
Oh, goodness. I'm a bit of a fan of, like, scrolling through TED, you know, so I'll go through, like, TED Talks and watch some of those. I like things like, you know, like the Hyatt Jeans newsletter and things like that go out.
I'm not familiar, but okay. That sounds good.
Yeah. That's super good. You know, people who do those mailers, we do a thing on a Friday called Wired Weekender, and it will have like a little, you know, it'll be an email prompt for, you know, the 10 stories that are exciting as that week or something like that. I love that kind of thing, bite-sized nuggets. I love Instagram. Like, I love hate Instagram. but yeah, that's probably all right. I love Flipboard. I love Apple News. You know, I'm on
that. You love everything.
I love most things.
Yeah. Favourite movie or documentary?
Oh, that's tough. Do you know what I've loved? The Abstract series. You know, the Abstract
do,
Design
yes,
series
great, great
on Netflix?
Show. Yeah. I'm sure they've got to do a second season of that, right?
It's so good. Like Scott, you know, who I was mentioning earlier, who's the old Wired US art director and editor. He was like the executive producer on there. So it really was like a good Wired club. You know, Platon was there. Who else was there? Bjark Ingels, Isaac Crawford. Oh, God. I love that whole, you know, to have Netflix. You know, Netflix are just killing it at the moment. And to have them do an entire series, you know, like a season on design,
yeah,
that's
know,
good,
right?
Like more Netflix.
Yeah, more power to it. It's
yeah.
Wicked. So before I ask the final question, where can people get hold of you if they want to get in touch?
I've got a website. It's my name, andrewdiprose.com. Or yeah, probably the easiest way is through that, because I've got an email address on there or whatever, or I'm my name, Andrew Diprose, on Instagram or whatever. People increasingly doing that, LinkedIn, the same old, same old.
Do you have any asks for the audience?
No.
No?
I'm just happy to be here chatting, talking magazines.
It's all good. And we briefly touched before the interview, actually, about if there was anything, any kind of giveaways or freebies we might be able to offer the audience. Have we got anything on the likelihood is?
We really have.
We do.
So what I'll do is I'll either put together like 6 months of Wired for the future or whatever. Somebody, I'm happy to mail those out, drop them around somebody's house or whatever. we'll get some copies of Wired. I've got a copy of the Ride Journal put by issue 10. There's only, like I was saying, I think there's only like six left or whatever on the website. So we're really running out of those now. So I got one of those put by. I've also got like a lovely, through the lovely Thames and Hudson, I've got a copy of The Mountains book I did with a brilliant photographer called Michael Blan. You should check out his work too. He does amazing. If you like, you know, environmental photography, cycling, he did this brilliant book, and I art directed it for him, and it's called Mountains. And I've got a copy of that too. So
loads of really good stuff.
Yeah.
So this is actually very exciting. So what I encourage anyone who's listening to do, well done for getting towards the end of the episode, number one, if you head over to my website, which is rickyrichards.com, you can sign up to the newsletter there. And in that, once a month, I send people out a message and you'll be able to find out how to get your hands on that there. So final question. Thank you so much for being here, by the way.
My pleasure.
If you could give the world one piece of advice to live a better and more meaningful life, what would it be?
Bit trad. Love thy neighbour.
Very nice. Right, I think it's a lovely way to end. Thank you so much, Andrew, for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Bye, everyone. That just about wraps up my interview with Andrew today. But before I go, I just wanted to summarise some of the key takeaways from this episode. Andrew has put in the years. If nothing else, it's very clear to see how passionate he is, and you can see why that's taken him to where he is today. Andrew is also a champion for quality. Create amazing things and people will respect and support what it is you create. Finally, for someone who is in such a great position, he remains humble and is nice to people, which goes a long way to build a support network of great people. That's all for me today. I hope you enjoyed the episode and got as much out of it as I did. Until next time, bye for now. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe and share. I'd also like to invite you to an ongoing project called the Move Me Mailing List. It contains links to all the great content I've uncovered each month, along with insights of any interesting opportunities I've discovered. You can subscribe to this by visiting my website at rickyrichards.com. A special thanks to Frankie Byrne and James Utting. They're the tech heads that make this show possible. The intro music was composed by Dom Storrs Fox. And thanks again to Rhys Chapman for introing me to Lou and Lizette, the wonderful folks at Factory Studios in London, where this show is recorded. Finally, wherever you are in the world, I hope you have a great day and keep creating.